You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Welcome to episode 1 in the weeds, where we look at weed and vegetation management across Tamaki Makaurau. This episode is proudly brought to you by 95BFM for the love of bees, and very kindly by Michael Lett Gallery. This is the fourth sub-episode of our first topic, glyphosates and weed management in Aotearoa, where we will be discussing thermal management.
Okay, so thermal weed management is where we're using heat and cold, even for controlling weeds, killing weeds. A very wide range of technologies have been tried. Virtually every conceivable thermal technology is being tried. So as we've been discussing, we're using steam. Flame has been mentioned, so literally trying to saute, if you like, weeds in situation using a flame. We've tried lasers. We've tried focused sunlight. We've tried carbon dioxide snow. We've tried liquid nitrogen. We have tried microwaves. And people have actually suggested ionizing radiation like gamma rays. But anybody with a smattering of nuclear science knows that's quite insane. So out of all the thermal techniques that are out there, and they have all been researched, flame and steam, and particularly in an urban area, steam is really the only option. Flame is a massive fire risk, so steam is the much more sensible option in an urban environment.
And what does the application of these thermal techniques look like?
Typically, the most current versions of the machines have a footprint of the heat exchangers that do the superheating of the water, and the pumps required to do that, they would fit onto a small outdoor table. They've got a footprint of about a metre by 700, and they may stand up to a metre tall. And so that's your machine and plant and the heat exchanger. But you need to have a water vessel to feed the water into, particularly if you're doing urban streets, because you can't obviously plug into a stationary. So the size of the vehicle will be dependent on how much water you want to carry, and the amount of water you carry and the amount of time, that will be dependent on the output of the machines. Now, typically for the Weed Technics machines, we're putting out for urban weed control 5 litres a minute, which I think is pretty efficient in the scale of all the machines that are available. And we find that is certainly enough to saturate the weeds on contact without having to dwell over them, unless they're very established with established root zones. So typically we will start off doing a fairly slow treatment on the first cycle, but each cycle we go through, the treatment will get faster and faster because there'll be fewer weeds. The weeds that are persisting, not resistant, but persisting, will be weaker, and there'll be newly germinated seedlings which are very easy and quick to kill. So these machines are mounted onto either utilities or small trucks, depending upon the water quantity that they are traveling with, and there is a hose, which is the delivery hose leading to a lance, that has a person attached to the lance directing that what we call satu steam, which is saturated steam and boiling water mix, onto the weeds. It's very similar with the foam stream method, which is putting a mixture of hot water and foam, and with the other hot water methods that are available, that they tend to be delivering more volume at a lower temperature. So it's a very manual method, but it's also very detailed in that it relies on the operator to visually see when that changing colour of the leaf, of the cells within the leaf exploding. They typically go from a dull green to a bright green. And it means that the delivery of the saturated steam boiling water is very directed, because it's being directed by an operator.
So as far as how it works on the road, basically exactly as Jeremy just outlined, the size of their vehicle really depends on the amount of water that you wish to have. Our machines either deliver 7 litres a minute or 12 litres a minute. Which machine is best really depends on the on how many weeds there are. So we've found in Auckland on some streets the 7 litres a minute is more than enough, and you're more than happy with that. But then in certain instances where there's just a huge amount of weed, particularly when it's not been tended to for a long time, then the 12 litre a minute machine would suit the purpose better. But as far as footprint is concerned, they're both roughly the same size.
So when you put a boom spray onto an ATV to run up the footpaths, doing an indiscriminate glyphosate spray or a herbicide spray, the majority of the application is going off target. It's hitting that hard surface. And, you know, the Orge watershed study in 2009, which is in France, showed that, you know, up to 30% of the herbicide could be washed off the footpaths with just 5 millimetres of rain. And what they did was they did a study of the agricultural influence, the runoff of the glyphosate and the additives in the Orge River just before the city, and then they did it after, and it was 179 times higher after the city because of the use of the glyphosate on hard surfaces. So I just want to sort of bring it back to the off-target damage. So they say it's faster, but unless you have a handheld applicator applying that glyphosate, just spraying that individual weeds, you are blanketing the concrete surfaces or the bitumen surfaces with off-target herbicide.
Probably worth just noting there, in Auckland, even though they are on ATVs when they're doing the glyphosate spraying, they do have a handheld applicator.
What do the differences in treatment cycles look like? And what is a treatment cycle for those of us that don't know? And what are the effects of having different treatment cycles?
So the difference with having a thermal technology is that it's usually an integrated process. So for instance, you know, the hot water, it's not just the hot water. A team will be going out and it's at walking pace, and they will be, say, weed trimming the edges of the grass. They will be brushing the gutter. They will be treating any overgrown vegetation with the hot water. So it is like an integrated process. So it's quite slow, but when they go down a street, they leave what's left as completely pristine. In areas where they use just glyphosate, the road, the channel, the curb and channel is done. It goes up one side of the street and back down the other. And then days might go by before they then have to come in to do the pavement edge. And typically glyphosate is used for vegetation edging, where the vegetation has grown over the pavement, they will spray it. But with thermal, the likelihood is that it will in fact be weed-eated, whippersnappered, whatever you want to call it. So this can be a big difference. So when you have evaluation of the cost or the environmental effects of doing these different weed management techniques, you're not comparing apples with apples. And we have had so much trouble trying to get this over to people who just want a simple figure. How much does it cost?
A cost that is commonly discussed, at least in issues of sustainability, and I think this has come into the discussion around treatment cycles as well, if I'm not mistaken, is around emissions. So emissions are front and center of most of Auckland Council's conversations of sustainability, and most of New Zealand's conversations of sustainability. How do both models of vegetation or weed management interact with our city's emissions?
This is a misnomer, and it is one of the things that we have found in this current, this is the first time basically that we have had a proposal, and this recommendation is to go to the use of glyphosate based purely on the fact that thermal technologies use more water, their carbon emissions are greater, and therefore that you've got an artificial weighing of benefits and risks and costs and whatever. And so this is the first time it's been brought into effect. And quite frankly, the documents and the details that we have been given are fundamentally wrong. And there is nowhere, although we'll deal with perhaps later, there's nowhere in that equation for human health and environmental costs. There is no equation put in there, because if you said to somebody, would you rather have your street sprayed with glyphosate, or do you want to have to pay the extra for possible carbon emissions but not have that effect? I mean, I think as Jody has said on many occasions, no child can get a little bit of cancer. So if you've got a possible cancer-causing agent, it should be weighed against, right, so the carbon emissions have to go up currently, but with thermal technology, you have the possibility of innovation. We've already got innovation. You have the possibility that over time, carbon emissions, water use will all decrease. All of the amazing innovations and ideas that are coming up can only be actually looked at under going with a thermal thing. So it's been cloaked in. We have to change because we're going to be putting out so many carbon emissions. There's nothing in that thing about, as Sarah could talk about, the carbon sequestration of keeping the weeds, of not mowing the grass.
The emissions story is a really important one. There is a conversation around the actual use of thermal technologies, and what has been proposed is that they use diesel, but in fact the cars themselves, the vehicles themselves, are not run on diesel. The heating of the water is actually run on diesel and can use a biodiesel. And I think it will be really interesting, because there's a conversation around innovation there that talks about, you know, how the hoses are affected by biodiesel and different innovations in regards to the materials used in that space. But also, there's a very important conversation that's completely been missing, which is around the production.
This was something I wanted to touch on, and I think it comes under costs as well. And costs, be that financial costs, human costs, social costs, economic, and emissions costs as well, and cycles. We look at the treatment cycles, and it is the application process from where we draw the information around emissions, if I'm not incorrect. But is there a discussion perhaps around the wider economics and production cycles when we look at the emissions costs and or the human costs? Are there not perhaps, and forgive me if my scientific and political knowledges don't line up in this, are there not some ethical issues as well around the extraction of some of these core chemicals that we use within Aotearoa?
You're describing a bit of an onion, kind of there's multiple layers going on there. At the heart of this, if they're talking about emissions, what is required and what Sarah was touching on and others as well, is a complete life cycle analysis, because we're not just concerned with the diesel that is being burnt to heat the water at the point of use. We're also concerned about the what's called embodied energy. So the energy that has gone in to make the glyphosate and ship it to the country where it's going to be used, all those other things. So if climate change emissions are going to be taken into account here, it has to be done correctly through methodologies such as complete life cycle analysis. Then, as Hannah and others have been touching on, you kind of move out into those layers and go, well, actually, the emissions is only one of multiple issues that we need to be looking at the same time across the whole spectrum. And if we're comparing emissions with something around human health, we say, are these of equal value? And so there's a lot of complexity to be unpacked if these comparisons are to be done properly.
There was one study done by Christofferson in 2007 this was in the early days of going through this process of transitioning cities in Europe to go from chemical weed control to thermal or to mechanical. And they compared flames, hot air, steam, used hot water, they used brushes, and done my own analysis of saturated steam with glyphosate. And now glyphosate on a carbon emissions basis, based on a per hectare usage in the urban environment, comes out to about 75 and a half kilograms per annum. Now, saturated steam comes out at about 65. The Waipuna system, which was a very inefficient hot water system, used about 196. So it was, you know, more than double. Hot air, which is very inefficient, was about 211. Flames, 94. So there is some research there. And we can go back to Barber, 2009, who calculated the glyphosate carbon emission was 28 kilograms per litre. So you know, using those as a basis, but none of these, you know, studies, that's 75 and a half kilograms per annum based on three treatment cycles, doesn't include the cost of the transport of getting it from China, which is the main place where it's manufactured, to transporting it, decanting it, storing it, transporting it, decanting it again, distribution, then its use, and then after that, the downstream cleansing and processing of those Roundup drums. And there'd be information about that from Drum Muster, who have seen the landfill from drums and decided, and they process drums. But enormous water usage. Rather than just looking at the application, you need to look at all the upstream and downstream, which is that embodied energy that I totally concur with Murph about. But with the thermal weed control and the water usage, I would say we're really honest about where we're using it. We're using diesel to heat the water, which is the most efficient way, and we're now looking into how we can change that to biodiesel, and water, which is, you know, used for killing weeds right there, and the only byproduct left is water. So, you know, it's to me it's a great use of water, and if you're in times of drought with no water, then generally the weed pressure is a lot less anyway.
That was something I quickly did want to note, because I think that has also come up within the discussions around council and around the implementation of the different vegetation management technologies. Is Tamaki Makaurau is currently in a drought. New Zealand is currently experiencing a lot of issues around water. And a few people that I have talked to who are not necessarily informed, but more informed on the issue, have raised this as an issue for thermal management. Are their concerns correct in the water usage placing further stress on Tamaki Makaurau and New Zealand's failing water infrastructure?
I would disagree, and I would suggest that in an area that is lacking rain, firstly, there's going to be less weed pressure. But if you go putting an application on of glyphosate or, you know, chemicals, and then you don't get any more rain, and you happen to do another application, then there's this continual build-up. Then your water courses, when they get that first flush, there's going to be an amazing amount of toxins that have built up, particularly in the urban environment, both from road transport and all the other environmental impurities that land on the ground. But if you add to that the toxins from the herbicides going into an already depleted watercourse, the concentrations in those watercourses is going to be naturally far higher. So to me, it just makes even more sense to be using a thermal weed control that is only putting water onto the footpaths and onto the hard surfaces.
Essentially what you're saying is that it will only do further damage to other parts of our water infrastructure if we're to include waterways and rivers and groundwater as surfaces. Is that somewhat correct for the layperson?
What I've heard is that they don't use potable water, so you don't use water that's clean enough to drink.
Yeah, yeah.
So in Auckland is not short of water that is not clean enough to drink.
This is a matter actually both Sarah and I have raised, that currently, for instance, you know, the hot water, and I'm assuming them, do not use potable water, so we're not imposing on that. But equally, there are areas where water could be drawn from lakes that, again, are not potable in any way. But more important, that the possibility of innovation of we should be drought-proofing every city in this country and probably all over the world. And the question that we raised, because this was as a project put forward by the hot water company, why are we not installing water tanks on every single council property, every council building in a park, so that the water can be collected, rainwater can be collected within the parks and within, you know, throughout the city to be used for these very things. Auckland Council has innovatively actually in the last year given sort of like a bylaw, a change of regulations to ensure that all householders can in fact now collect water from their roof to be used in their gardens. So our question that Sarah and I asked was, why then would you not council itself drought-proof itself by going into this innovative idea of collecting all the rainwater for use in the thermal sheds? That is the sort of innovation that and will bring down the cost.
I guess that what we discovered while we were working out there is, well, not that we discovered this, but one is that we don't need to use clean drinking water for weed control. So once the water restrictions came in through Auckland and they opened up non-potable water sites, then we were very happy to use water either directly out of lakes or slightly cleaner water. It didn't really matter to us as long as our machines are filtered, then that's absolutely fine. So sort of taking that away, then that obviously isn't quite as big of an issue if we can use non-potable water. But also the figures that they've taken from us is, as I'm saying, we did a lot of areas that hadn't been weeded for quite some time. And so the areas that we did weeded were very, very weedy. And so with a thermal application, the more weeds there are, the more water you're going to use. And so that one slows your forward speed and has you using basically the maximum amount of water that your machine can output, you know. But once you're sort of through that sort of DR weed control and you're back to normal weed control, then you know you don't have your hand on the trigger the entire time, and that takes down your CO2 emissions, that also takes down your water use. And so I guess that's sort of what I would like to say,
right.
Say on that. There's definitely ways to lower the water consumption and lower the CO2 emissions just by basically once you're on top of the weed control, then these issues are going to help to sort themselves out.
We have the same experience over here in that we can manage non-potable water, and the precautionary tale from Matt's experience there is quite often if you're called in to do a pilot or a trial site, will often be in an area that hasn't been treated for a while because they really want to give the thermal weed control a good test for its money. But then they use that as the basis for extrapolating the ongoing costs.
Exactly.
With the assumption that it's always going to cost that much. And quite often that plays straight into their hands of really being resistant to change and moving to a hydrothermal weed control method.
This is something I wanted to touch on, and we've been talking about developing an evidence base or developing trials so we have that evidence and the scientific background to present. What is a fair trial for innovation?
Actually doing it. We don't need trials, because the reality is that steam, foam technology and the hot water have been used all over the world. We have got the results and the data from actual in-use over years. So, for instance, the hot water has been used on the roads in Auckland for 30-odd years. We have got the evidence from there. They don't need to do a trial because they have been out there doing it. And so, therefore, the costings are straightforward because the costings have been actual in use.
Yes, I guess with the improve of technology and the way that things have come, if they did want to do a trial, I think that a fair trial would be an annual an annual trial, so for it to be over 12 months, and then you get every part of the year, you go through every season, and you manage to, you know, and the first years for us in the thermal game is often going to be the hardest because you're having to try and get on top of it. You sort of take out that base level of weeds, so you may have an extra treatment cycle in that first year. But I think over 12 months, you begin to see the benefits of it. And for example, with some of the stuff that we're doing on the Curban Channel there, I think we averaged around a kilometre in an hour in Auckland, and that's really saying how weedy it is. I was down in Christchurch last week, and I did some Curban Channel with the operators of City Care down there, and they've been running thermal around their streets reasonably efficiently for the last couple of years, and we dusted off 2Ks easily within an hour. So that sort of shows you where when you're actually on top of things, things will start to move a lot smoother.
Right.
And I think Oscar, what's really, really important needs to be stressed, if you're doing a year trial, it needs to be by a skilled practitioner that is vested in doing this work, rather than sort of a reluctant big contractor that's got no real interest in this. I think that's quite critical. Another thing about just moving back to the concept of saving water as an Australian, where is the consideration for changing their vegetation management, for changing the length of their grass, for looking at the reduction in water use for new plantings, to make sure they don't need to irrigate? You know, they put dry grasses in, they put, you know, native species that are drought tolerant in. So it wouldn't just be looking at, you know, steam, you know, treatment. We wouldn't only be concerned with that, would we? We'd be concerned with the right wider remit over a year.
Biodiversity. That's something that we've kind of stepped around the whole time, but is another huge issue when we discuss sustainability within council frameworks, within government frameworks, and within general ecological frameworks. What is the difference in biodiversity loss that we see comparative to both models?
I'll chip in with that one. It depends entirely how you use it. You know, if you're using chemicals or thermal and you're wanting to get rid of lots and lots of vegetation, that's going to have a massive biodiversity impact. If you both use both of them sparingly, so it's not so much the direct technology, it's more how you're using them.
And one of the things I would like to ask is, you know, we look at the fact that, say, tui birds and piwaka wakas are, you know, they're up in the trees all the time, whereas you've got the wax eyes that'll come through and they'll graze seeds, and they'll come through and they'll be the ground-dwelling birds. And I think there is evidence that the tree-dwelling birds are more resilient. So if you look at the effect to bird colonies, I would, you know, there's such a lack of science showing what the exposures are to the indigenous bird populations. And we know when we look at the runoff of, you know, chemicals into water, it's not just nutrients, it's chemicals. And we know that we've got all these endangered fish species. So, you know, it is very difficult for scientists to get funding to look at environmental chemicals.
Can I just make the point that biodiversity actually starts in the soil, and our biggest opportunity is to build soil microorganism activity and harvest carbon in the soil. And we can only do that with living soils. And every time you apply a herbicide, you kill that opportunity. So biodiversity and climate change starts with soils and building up soil health.
Jeremy, you've had a similar experience around the contractors perhaps using a machine in a non-efficient way, like Jody was talking about before. And I wanted to talk about something as well that was said, and just generally when we look at the place of weed management compared to centralized systems and localized systems, these large chemical models create ease in controlling plants. And with ease, perhaps they, and forgive me if I've overstepped in saying this, produce maybe a lack of care because of how simple it is to do. And so people are disengaged with what they're doing. So it almost sounds like these chemical models are replacing what could be huge opportunities for employment and local employment for those who are interested in this area and within urban horticulture and even agricultural industries with toxins that will denigrate the soils to the point where we lose the ability to sequester carbon, and then we're again back at this point of talking about emissions. Is this a huge assumption that I'm making, or is this kind of what's going on?
I think it ties in very well with a paradigm shift that has to happen. We've now got, you know, major sort of city contracts being held by what are called facility managers. Okay, so they're managing exterior, you know, assets, parks, gardens, and they call themselves facility managers. That's a total disconnect from what our role is as landscape stewards. So I came through horticultural school, and I've got a very strong sense that when we are managing a landscape, we need to be good stewards of the landscape, and that's about building biodiversity and being, you know, nurturers and managers. So as soon as you shift to that war on weeds, then they go for the sort of chemical warfare, and we need to shift to be good landscape stewards, because it ties in with that whole confluence of moving away from chemicals, which have replaced good jobs, and going back to having more gardeners. And, you know, there's a whole range of services that gardeners can do. One of them is weed management, and you don't need a lot of skill. You just need to be trained at how to differentiate different greens, really, in order to pick the different vegetation. And to be able to use the different sort of weeding skills, the mechanical and the thermal, etc. So it creates local employment that is green and safe and meaningful, rather than taking this sort of chemical, low-cost chemical addiction. If you look at chemical operators, they have an attitude of, it's a bit, you know, bit robust, bit testosterone driven, and they've got their pumps and they've got the chemical equipment, and it's, let's get this job done. And it has no care for the environment around it. It provides profits to the facility managers, it provides profits to the chemical companies, leaves a whole legacy of damage and hidden costs, and that could be replaced with one or two more green, healthy, caring jobs.
We refer to it there.
Could I just say that this actually is a fundamental problem that we've moved into. We've moved so far away from community orientated jobs and management. So for instance, when before Auckland Transport took over, before we went to a super city, there were 27 different facilities, you know, areas that were managed by that area. When the super city took over, they reduced this to 9. So they condensed these into large areas. Auckland Council, in introducing their community facilities programs, actually took it even lower. There's only 3 community facility contractors, and they have to deal with, you know, the buildings and cleaning the toilets and the everything else to do with facilities. And so when that happened, all of the specialist vegetation weed control companies all went out of business, because they could not compete for a community facilities contractor, because they didn't have that ability to, you know, to do the buildings. So we ended up with 3 very large companies in Auckland, and they are so remote now that even the thermal contractors, instead of being contractors in their own right, which is what they were, for instance, a city would employ a contractor to do all the vegetation control, they are now not only subcontractors, they are subcontractors. Therefore, either their margins are reduced until it is impossible for them to actually do the job, or it ends up that they literally go out of business.
The hidden contracts within the contracts means that the elected representatives can't actually gauge what the true costs are. and this can be, you know, sequestered so that political issues then come to the fore rather than actual true cost accounting.
Jeremy mentioned the low-cost chemical alternative, and Jody was just talking about how we can't necessarily judge the costs, or it's difficult to gauge the full costs. One of the kind of metrics, I guess is the term, that council and other people use when trying to select these technologies or select processes that they want to use in relation to vegetation management, I believe, not to speak out of place, is cost per kilometre. So when we look at it as a cost per kilometre, the most basic thing, even if that disregards everything else, what do we find out?
Yeah, well, I believe that the cost per kilometre that they had in that paper is certainly a lot higher than what we could do it for, and that's at a 1.1 kilometre per hour forward pace, and just to go back to Christchurch last week, where we easily, like, no issues at all, covered 2 kilometres in under an hour, that instantly brings that cost down. You know, it halves it for the thermal application. So the costs that they're working on there are what has been done, but that's been done in a disaster recovery situation, and so there's a lot of scope for that cost to come down even further. But even on the kilometre basis that they were doing, they came out at around $3,500 dollars per kilometre, and I believe we could do it a lot cheaper than that, in between the glyphosate and fatty acid numbers.
Right.
Yeah, we have, again, which is back to this, the whole procurement position, is that the cost, for instance, of hot water, and I've also talked to Matt about this as well, is that what we have now is a cost that the community facilities contractors, who have no understanding of how to use the thermal technologies, are giving an estimate of how much they think it will cost them to do a thermal technology on the streets. And it's come out at $3,600 an average. That's what we understand has happened. Whereas the reality is that the hot water contractor for 15 years was doing the road corridor for approximately $1,200 a kilometre.
So just quickly, Matt and Hannah, when you say per kilometre, just to ensure that people listening understand, that includes the mowing and strimming, so just the entire package?
Well, in Auckland, we have a situation where there is no mowing in the urban area because everybody has to maintain their own berms. In the rural area, that's a separate thing. The mowing that's done in the rural area is a different matter. So yes, it includes the cost of the strimming, the mechanical, the sweeping, everything that. So that is a number, as I say, that we know is fact because it is accountable. We have documents and everybody knows that. So for council to say, well, it'll cost $3,500 per linear kilometre, is an absolute and utter nonsense because they know that this is not true.
For reference, say we can do it for just over $1,000. What does that mean per kilometre, and what is that in comparison to a chemical spray?
Well, the numbers that they had in the paper for the chemical spray are around $800, and that chemical spray is estimated off 6 treatment cycles a year. So you visit the same kilometre 6 times a year, and the assumptions that they've used across the board for every thermal application is 12 times a year. Whereas I'm sure, you know, Jeremy and I would contest to that's not the case. We would not need to be out there 12 times a year. I guess that's a way to me that it seems like the numbers are higher. I can see why they're assuming that, maybe in the worst months of the year. But I mean, I don't think we need to be out there 12 times a year, but we need some actual recent Auckland data, which unfortunately I've only got 3 months of, and we didn't ever go back to do a second treatment. Depends on the amount of weed on the street, and so when we start out like that in Auckland, which is a particularly weedy city, it slows us down by 50% compared to what we'd do in Christchurch at this time of year. So it's one of those things that I can't really give you an exact clear. I can give you a worst case, which I think I calculated around 2,300 per kilometre for a worst case scenario, 12 times a year, around that number. But I believe that figure can and will come lower and lower as we start to move faster and decrease the treatment cycles.
I just don't think it's possible to determine like a meaningful comparative dollar value cost for thermal versus chemical. They are two completely different functions. One has a whole lot of hidden costs and is heavily subsidised by the chemical manufacturers, and the other is a clean green method of employment that manages the landscape with good stewardship. Now, there are too many variable factors that really play a role in the frequency of the application. For example, Leichhardt in the inner city suburb of Sydney, which we looked after for many years, requires between 6 and 8 treatments per annum, and we live in a temperate climate with good rain. Weeds grow all year round here, 6 to 8 times per annum, depending upon how much rain we get. Whereas over in Fremantle, was only 2 to 3 times per annum. So it's really variable, but of course it's going to cost more than chemical. But there's just so many reasons why we should be steering away from chemical. Let's look at the reasons why we want to move away from it. And then that changes the whole cost paradigm.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.